underwear and likely on his way to the bathroom, fell to the floor dead, with half his head missing. A second man, who had been asleep, now scrambled for his weapon. Harbath shot him too and exited the room. Palmer and Ashby were making their way down the hallway toward him, and Harbath waved them off. Crossing back toward the kitchen, he located a staircase and signaled for them to follow him upstairs. The stairs creaked worse than the hallway floor. Undeterred, he kept moving. When he reached the top, there was a door immediately to his right. Reaching for the knob, he twisted it and pushed the door open. It was a small office of some sort, stacked with Pelican cases and electronic equipment. Standing back, he sent Palmer in to clear it. Moving down a narrow hallway, the next door he encountered was on his left and opened onto a small walk-in closet. There were only two rooms left. One of them was bound to have Damien. Pushing open the door to the first room, he could see that it was a guest room of some sort and that the bed had been slept in. He was about to signal Ashby when suddenly his entire field of vision was obscured. The man must have been pressed against the wall and had leapt out the minute he saw the door open. All Harbath could do was react. The man was literally on top of him. He couldn't get his weapon into a good enough angle to shoot, so he snapped his head forward, driving his night vision goggles into his assailant's face. The man staggered backward, blood pouring down his face. Instead of surrendering, though, he charged again. This time, Harbath had enough distance and dropped him with two shots to his head. That left one final door. Harbath crossed over to it and listened. There was no sound, but there hadn't been in his other two encounters either. Signaling the team, he twisted the doorknob. It was locked. Taking a step back, he kicked it open and they poured in. Like the other room, the bed was unmade, but there was no sign of its recent occupant. As Ashby quickly checked beneath it, Palmer checked the closet, and Harbath crossed to the bathroom. It was secured by a sliding pocket door that hadn't been closed all the way. Through the crack, Harbath could see the man identified as Jeffrey, Damien's valet, putting a shotgun in his mouth. He took a step back and fired five shots in rapid succession through the door. The valet screamed in agony as he dropped the shotgun onto the bathroom floor. Harbath ripped open the door and kicked the weapon out of the way. This guy wasn't going to get the luxury of taking the coward's way out and committing suicide. All of his shots had been below the waist, including the valet's groin. Leaning over, he placed the hot suppressor against the wound, and the valet screamed even louder.
"That was from Helena," Harbath said. "Now, tell me where Damien is."
Chapter 54. Bird Key, Bahamas. Two nights later. Harbath jumped from the ramp of his C-17 Globemaster transport plane, popped his chute, and glided through the warm night air toward the crystalline water below. Undoing his chest strap and belly band, he splashed down, 32 nautical miles north-northwest of Nassau. As soon as his feet touched the water, he disconnected his leg straps and swam free of the main lift webs, leaving his rig to slowly sink. With his dry bag bobbing in front of him, he paddled toward Pierre Damien's tropical 250-acre Bahamian refuge. Francis, a British sportsman and heir to the Standard Oil fortune, had originally developed the private island in the 1940s. In addition to being an incredible amateur golfer, and a member of both the English track and fencing teams, he had also been a renowned aviator who helped develop the ejector seat. The island had played host to the rich and powerful of its day. Among Francis's many notable guests were Marlene Dietrich, Greta Garbo, Noel Coward, Rock Hudson, David Niven, the Duke of Windsor, and even King Leopold III of Belgium. It was a tradition of hospitality that Pierre Damien had largely eschewed, preferring instead to keep his ownership of the island secret. Even the Mossad had been unaware of it. Jeffrey had given up its existence, but not without extreme coercion. There was something off about him. Though he had been in great pain as Harvath had interrogated him, he seemed to enjoy parts of it. The man had problems, lots of them. Those problems, though, created a psychological makeup that had complemented Damien's. Renfield-like, Jeffrey was devoted both to him and to his ultimate objective. They were a match made in hell. Jeffrey had not only conducted the torture of Helena, but had let her gang rape once Damien had fled. Like his employer, he was beyond evil. He had been left behind at the Virginia Redoubt to handle communications and to carry out any of Damien's dirty work should Linda Landon or any of the others fail to carry out their responsibilities. The men Harvath had encountered and killed at Clifton had been in the process of assembling supplies to augment what was already at the fallback location. According to Jeffrey, the only means of communicating with Damien was a highly encrypted email system that was sent via satellite burst. None of that mattered to Harvath. He had no intention of communicating with Damien electronically. He wanted to chat with him face to face. As he made landfall on the eastern side of the island, he picked his way across the rocks, careful not to leave any footprints in the sand. Once back in the brush, he unpacked his dry bag and assembled his equipment. Even though he didn't have to traverse much terrain, his plan had been to travel light. He had packed an H&K 45 compact tactical, a Knights Armament Company suppressor, and a CRKT James Williams Shinbu knife. In and out, cold, hard, and fast. After lacing up his boots, he conducted one last comms check.
Moonracer, this is Norseman. How do you read?
Reading you 5x5, Nicholas replied.
Current target locations?
Nicholas relayed what he was seeing via satellite, and Harvath marked the men's positions on his map. He then signed off. It was time to move. He followed the road from the beach until he reached a fork, and then headed west toward the clutch of whitewashed guest cottages on the other side of the narrow island. About a half a kilometer from the main residence was where Damien would be housing the security team he had flown in. According to Nicholas, there was no activity. No one at that location was standing guard. Stepping off the road as he approached, he examined a series of support buildings. There was a garage, a maintenance shed, and a storage building, all of which were devoid of people. The next structure he came across appeared to be a caretaker's cottage, and he slipped soundlessly inside via an unlocked screen door. Clean dishes sat in a rack next to the sink, and the kitchen curtains fluttered in the ocean breeze of the open windows. Attached to the refrigerator was a to-do list of groundskeeping items, accompanied by a list entitled Meal Plans for Mr. Damien. Raising his pistol, Harvath crept toward the bedroom. At the door, he took up the slack in his trigger and then eased it open. It slid quietly on well-oiled hinges. In the bed was an older couple fast asleep. They were not combatants. Lowering his pistol, he retreated from the room, closing the door behind him and leaving their home. Pushing on to the beach, he examined a large boathouse packed with all types of watercraft. An overhead winch system was used to place the selected toy onto a trailer. The trailer then rode on a narrow set of rails down into the water where the ski boat, sailboat, wave runner, and even a bright yellow mini-sub could be launched. Confident that no one was inside the boathouse, Harvath moved on to the first guest cottage. The sound of the waves crashing along the beach masked his approach. Like the caretaker's cottage, this cottage had its windows open and storm shutters pinned back to allow the breeze in. It was divided into two bedrooms, each with its own entrance facing the beach. Through the curtains, he could make out a figure sleeping in each room. Stepping around to the beach side, he silently entered the first cottage door. Even though the man was asleep, Harvath recognized him instantly. He was one of Jan Hendrick's men, who had helped butcher everyone in the Matumeni clinic, as well as the village back in Congo. With his pistol pointed at him, Harvath kicked the corner of the man's bed frame and waited for him to open his eyes. When he did, Harvath raised his index finger to his lips and warned him to be quiet.
"I'm the one who kidnapped your boss in Bunya," he whispered. "I wanted you to know that all of those people you murdered for Mr. Damien in Congo, the men, the women, and the children, they were all immune to the virus."
The man's look of shock quickly turned to something else. When he opened his mouth to yell for help, Harvath shot him twice in the head and quickly moved to the next room. Here, another butcher lay sleeping, and Harvath repeated his drill, kicking the bed frame and making sure the man knew why he was there before shooting him in the face. The next cottage was empty, as were the nearby toilet and shower facilities. The one after that, though, had two more of Hendrik's mercenaries, and Harvath rapidly dispatched them both. He checked the final cottage, only to find it empty. He knew where everyone else was. Inserting a fresh magazine into his weapon, he stepped outside and headed toward the main house half a kilometer up the beach. Halfway there was another empty support building, which Harvath cleared before closing in on Damien's residence. The large main house was at the tip of the island, with stunning views of the ocean in three directions. It was shaped like a U, with a two-story central structure and two single-story wings jutting back off each end. It had all been built of stone quarried right on Bird Key and whitewashed like the cottages. There was also a dramatic walled pool and a paved courtyard surrounded by archways. The entire property was simple and elegant, a reminder of an era long gone. The feature Harvath was interested in the most, though, was the external stone staircase that led up to a terrace off the master bedroom and from there up onto the roof. But before he could get to Damien, he needed to get through the rest of his security team. Two men were on a roving patrol around the outside of the house. That was where Harvath started. His suppressor was exceptional, but he needed to make sure that absolutely no sound traversed the open air and gave him away. Securing his pistol, he drew the shinbu. It was 14.75 inches in length, 9.25 of which was its high-carbon steel tapered tip blade designed for slashing and deep penetration. It had been created for special forces operatives to employ when their firearms couldn't be employed, like right now. Using one of the archways of the open-air courtyard to conceal himself, Harvath waited for the first guard to pass, and then he sprang. He clamped his left hand over the man's mouth and bent his head back as far as he could. Plunging the blade up and through his rib cage on an angle, he punctured both lungs and lacerated his heart. He held on to the guard until he ceased struggling and then dragged his body off to the side where it wouldn't be seen. Wiping his blade on the man's clothes, he returned behind the stone archway and waited for the next guard. Minutes later, he appeared. But then, something went wrong. Instead of passing, he stopped, right on the other side of the arch. Had he seen something? Did he know somehow that Harvath was there? The only word that came to Harvath's mind was the one that rhymed with truck. The man was so close, he could hear him breathing. And then, he couldn't. But it wasn't because he had walked away. It was because he was about to attack. Harvath charged to his left, but the man wasn't there. He had gone in the opposite direction. Pivoting, Harvath sent the tip of his blade back in the direction he had come and followed it with his body. The guard had indeed come around the other side of the wide column, and Harvath's blade caught him in the lower abdomen. He didn't waste any time. Pushing the knife the rest of the way in, he then jerked it upward, but the guard slammed his rifle down on top of it. He then swung the butt of his weapon as hard as he could toward Harvath's head. Harvath jerked back, getting caught in the side of the face with a glancing but painful blow. Bringing his rifle around, the guard prepared to fire. Harvath would get only one chance. Pulling the blade from the man's stomach, He canted it 45 degrees and sent it sailing upward. It caught the guard beneath his right ear. With a quick twist, Harvath finished the job. Two down, two to go. One guard was sitting outside the main entrance. The other was sitting near the French doors that opened onto the pool. At this point, Harvath didn't care if either of the men heard his suppressed pistol. By the time it happened, there would be no one they could call for backup. He decided to take the man at the main entrance first. Hugging the south wing, he used the tall, ornamental grasses Damien had planted to his advantage. When he was close enough to the front door and had a clean enough shot, Harvath took it. He depressed his trigger in rapid succession. The first two shots to the man's chest caused him to bend forward. The shot to his head snapped him backward and out of his chair. Now, it was pool time. The final guard was right where Nicholas had said he would be. He was also committing a cardinal sin while on guard duty. He was smoking. Harvath had been able to smell the smoke long before he saw the man. Sitting in the darkness, he waited until the man took another deep drag on his cigarette and then shot him twice through the head, splattering the French doors behind him. Now, only Damien remained. While Harvath had originally considered the exterior staircase, he now decided against it. The master bedroom had too many windows, and if Damien was awake, there was too great a chance that he would see him coming. Instead, Harvath returned to the main entrance, rolled the dead guard out of the way, and let himself inside. The home was just as he had imagined. From its marble entry floor and fixtures to its sweeping staircase and green palm frond wallpaper, it looked frozen in the 1940s. All it was missing was Humphrey Bogart or Lauren Bacall passing through in search of more gin for another batch of martinis. Testing his weight on the stairs, Harvath carefully moved upward toward Damien's bedroom. The second floor was decorated much the same as the first. There was a series of lesser bedrooms, all of which were empty. Arriving at the master, Harvath raised his suppressed pistol and pushed open the door. Not only was the room empty, but the bed had not been slept in. What the hell had Hendrick's men been guarding? After checking the master bath, Harvath retraced his steps and rechecked the rest of the rooms on the second floor. Where the hell was he? Moving quietly back downstairs, Harvath checked the entire south wing. There was a library, a workout room, a billiards room and bar, and a sauna. But no Pierre Damien. Coming back into the main structure, he checked the living and family rooms and then proceeded into the dining room. Just beyond it, he found him. Damien was in a glass solarium just before the kitchen. Several panels of glass had been retracted so he could smell and listen to the ocean. His back was to Harvath, but he knew he was there. "Some of you Jews are more clever than I give you credit for. I have been wondering if you would come." There was a newspaper in his lap, a glass of red wine, and its bottle on a table to his right. "Hands where I can see them," said Harvath as he maneuvered around him. "How many did the Mossad send? Just you?" "Just me," Harvath replied, now face to face with Pierre Damien. "And I wasn't sent by the Mossad."
"No?"
Everything about the man was perfectly manicured, his hair, his nails, right down to his crisp, pressed robe and pajamas.
"You're an American citizen," said Harvath. "The United States has no intention of letting Israel have you."
"So, America has sent you to kill me?"
"That depends."
"On what?"
"Whether you cooperate. We'll start by me telling you one last time to keep your hands where I can see them."
Damien returned his hands to the arms of his chair, but nodded toward his drink.
"May I?"
"In a minute."
He looked at Harvath, trying to figure him out. Did he have a weakness, something he could exploit? He was very difficult to read.
"What is it the United States wants?"
"An admission."
Damien smiled,
and his smile then turned to laughter. Now I know you're here to kill me.
Why's that?
Because you don't know the first thing about negotiating. Harvath adjusted his pistol, pressed the trigger, and shattered the 1947 bottle of Chateau Cheval Blanc next to him.
As I was saying, he continued, the United States wants your full and complete confession.
Discharging the weapon had startled Damien, but he tried not to show it. In exchange for what? He asked, slowly wiping bits of glass and red wine from his sleeve.
That depends on how thoroughly you cooperate.
You'll have to give me some sort of a hint.
I don't have to give you anything, Harvath replied. But I will tell you this. I am going to get a confession out of you one way or the other. It's up to you how painful it will be.
And if I cooperate?
If you cooperate, then as an American citizen, there are a number of things that the United States is prepared to do.
None of which you'll tell me.
Harvath simply stared at him.
Maybe you're a better negotiator than I thought, said Damien. Where do we start?
The man rambled on for over 2 hours, quite convinced of his clarity of vision and moral superiority. He repeatedly attempted to explain to Harvath that there no longer would be any such thing as a United States, that the concept of the nation-state was finished. Harvath's was a fool's errand, he stated, the wind in his sails the last breath of a dying empire. Within weeks, America as he knew it would cease to exist, and when it did, along with all of the other sovereign nations, the world's survivors would seek a new kind of leadership, a global leadership. The United Nations would then step forward and take up that mantle, and a new golden age of enlightenment, informed by a healthy respect and stewardship of the planet, would begin. Harvath remained inscrutable throughout, only speaking when he needed to nudge the man back on track. When he had what he wanted, he returned the small digital video recording device to its weatherproof case and slid it back into his pocket. He now had everything he had come for.
What now? Damien demanded. You have what you asked for. What about me?
Harvath looked at him a long time before responding.
You have a choice. You return for a trial.
The man scoffed at the idea, interrupting Harvath.
Where? At The Hague? Or maybe someplace more Nuremberg-esque? Perhaps the Jews could muster enough energy to have me extradited to Jerusalem or Tel Aviv. Maybe America would want me tried in front of its own Supreme Court. Better yet, let's have it in Congo or in front of the savages in Mecca. It can be televised around the world so that everyone can revel in my conviction and then watch me swing from the gallows.
Harvath waited until the man had finished and said,
Or?
Or what?
Or exile.
Exile? Damien laughed. As in sending Napoleon to Elba?
Except you wouldn't be going to Elba.
The man laughed even louder.
Who cares?
I thought you'd feel that way,
said Harvath, as he raised his pistol and fired.
Don't worry. The rest of your colleagues will be joining you shortly.
Chapter 55.
Secretary Fleming died shortly after Harvath transmitted the footage from Damien's interrogation on Bird Key. The kill orders he had signed, though, remained open. When the Secretary of Defense ascended to the position of acting president, he was unable to reach Harvath. Moving like a cold wind through the capitals of Europe, Harvath was death. Riding upon his pale horse, he struck with great fury and without mercy. No matter where the members of the plenary panel hid, Harvath found them, and when he found them, he killed them. When the last one was dead, he made his way from Lisbon to Malta, threw everyone out of the Solarium interrogation site, and killed Jan Hendrik. He then tracked down a case of Jack Daniels and stayed drunk for 3 days. He couldn't watch the news. He couldn't listen to the radio. He couldn't think about the future. There was no future. People around the world were dying so quickly and in such massive numbers that the bodies couldn't be buried fast enough. When Vela came and tried to talk to him, Harvath took a shot at him. It was a warning. If he had wanted to kill him, he would have, even as drunk as he was. It was one of the lowest points in his life. 36 hours later, a priest showed up. It was as if he had appeared out of nowhere, somehow bypassing all of the solarium security systems and walking in.
"Jesus," Harvath exclaimed when he saw him.
"Far from it," the man replied.
"What are you doing here, Peo?"
"I've come to save you."
"From what?"
"From yourself."
Harvath began to lift his pistol, but set it back down, and picked up his half-finished bottle of Jack instead.
"Do you want to talk?" Peo asked.
"Sure. How the hell did you find me?"
"A little bird told me."
Harvath began laughing.
"Padre, you should be above short jokes."
Peo smiled, but it was a smile mixed with pity. He had been right where Harvath was now. Before he was a priest, he had been an intelligence officer in Madrid. He had lived through the horror of the Madrid train bombing and losing his wife. He had then hunted the men responsible, succumbing to his bloodlust. And when alcohol failed to assuage his pain and guilt, he had turned to drugs. It was a spiral that led him right to the very gates of hell. Death was extending its cold hand to him when a priest found and rescued him.
"Perhaps referring to Nicholas as a little bird is unfair. Let me try again. A friend told me you might need help."
"I'm fine," said Harvath.
Peo looked around at the disarray.
"I can see that."
"You're wasting your time, Padre. There are others who need you more than me."
"Maybe, but I'm here now. Would you like to talk?"
he asked again. He was the most tenacious priest Harvath had ever met.
"What's the death toll now?"
"On Malta?"
"Everywhere."
"It's not good,"
Peo conceded.
"I didn't think so."
"But there is a silver lining."
Harvath chuckled.
"Really? What's that? Less traffic?"
"It's slowing."
That was something Harvath hadn't expected. Sitting up, he said,
"Slowing how?"
"Some experts, not all, think it is burning itself out. Apparently it was too lethal. Killed too quickly. Getting the vaccinated out to help the unvaccinated appears to have made a huge difference. Nicholas tells me you thought of that."
"Somebody else thought of it."
"Modesty from a man in your condition is quite charming."
Harvath gave his friend the finger. Padre Peo smiled.
"This isn't you, Scott."
"You have no idea, Father."
"Maybe not, but I think I do."
Harvath didn't reply.
"You chose to shoulder a great burden, to do things that no one should ever be asked to do. But you did them. And if you hadn't, evil would be allowed to run unchecked."
Harvath still didn't reply. Peo was about to say more, but decided to remain silent. He knew Harvath well enough to know that he wasn't a man to be pushed. Reaching for the bottle of Jack Daniels, the priest poured himself a cup, sat down against the near wall, and said,
"Salute,"
as he took a drink. They sat in silence for at least an hour, passing the bottle back and forth while Harvath avoided Peo's gaze.
"These aren't the circumstances under which I usually hear confession, but if you'd like to confess, I'll hear yours,"
the priest said. Harvath started to laugh, and it only built from there.
"What?"
Peo asked.
"Someday, when it's all over and we're old men, maybe we'll sit together, and I'll confess. Until then, keeping it inside is what keeps me going."
The priest knew the feeling all too well, and he nodded.
"I understand."
"In the meantime," Harvath said,
looking around and done wallowing.
I think I need to get back home.
Padre Pio smiled at him.
I can make that happen.
Chapter 56. Northern Virginia. Thank you, Reed Carlton said as he walked onto the nursing home veranda and handed Harvath a hot cup of coffee. For everything. The sun was slowly rising, chasing away the overnight cold. In the parking lot below was the truck Harvath had sent Palmer and Ashby to stuff full of supplies and bring back from Damien's Clifton Farm estate. Carlton had promised the nursing home staff that if they stayed and saw to the patients, he would find a way to take care of them and their families. He began by going person by person, verifying who had been vaccinated. All of the nursing home staff had, as had most of their family members. Those who hadn't were made comfortable in their own protected wing. With that out of the way, he had established a guard schedule. A nursing home with pharmaceuticals and a commercial kitchen was a prime target for looters. By the time Harvath returned, the looting was still going on, but was much more sporadic. He had insisted on being added to guard duty. Their small group of battle-hardened operators continued to be more than enough to beat back the rabble that came sniffing around. Twice a day he spoke to Lara via sat phone and ended each call by telling her how much he loved her. He never spoke of his bloody path through Europe or his bottoming out in Malta. For now, some secrets would still remain a part of who he was.
How is President Porter? Harvath asked the old man.
They think he's going to make it.
How?
The virus has about a 70% lethality. They beat the hell out of it with antivirals, plus an experimental AIDS drug. It seems to be doing the trick.
Have they shared that with the other countries?
Totally.
What about Bensi and Helena? Harvath asked.
They're both still recovering at Camp Perry. He didn't get the vaccine like she did, so they've also got him on antivirals and under observation. So far, so good.
Any word from Jessica Decker?
Kinshasa, like the rest of Africa, looks like the zombie apocalypse. Very few got the good flu vaccine, but even there, African hemorrhagic fever is quickly burned out. Your SAS team brought Jumbo, Leonce, and Pepsi to Kinshasa and linked up with Decker. From what we hear, they're weathering the storm. They're doing okay.
Harvath was glad to hear that.
And with everything else taken care of, it was time for him to go. Taking a sip of his coffee, he prepared to speak, but the old man cut him off. You need to get going. I've reached out to General McCollum. A plane has already been arranged for you. As the Cessna Citation 10 jet raced toward Anchorage, Harvath tried to forget everything that had happened, and instead looked forward to what was coming. Pouring himself a large glass of Woodford Reserve, he put the cork back in the bottle and sat back down in his seat. As he sipped his drink, he tried to let go. He had done his best. Whatever happened now was beyond his control. Like his mother had said over and over again to him, you can't always control the situation you find yourself in, but you can control how you react to it. It was a nice saying, though he doubted whether his mother had envisaged this kind of situation. That said, the disease, by all accounts, was slowing. That was a good thing. In the United States, the government had adopted a duck-and-cover posture. Every effort was being made to take care of the sick, while a quarantine remained in effect in the hopes that the virus would finally burn itself out. All Harvath cared about at this point, though, was getting to Lara. He slept for a while, but not near enough to kill the time. After watching a movie, he tried to go back to sleep, but it was fitful. When the jet finally landed in Anchorage, he couldn't wait to jump out of it and onto the float plane that would fly him up to Lara and Marco. Bag in hand, he thanked the pilots and charged down the air stairs, hurrying toward his next leg. Halfway down, he was surprised to see her standing there, waiting for him.
she had never looked more beautiful. As he moved toward her, he was knocked out of the way by Nicholas's hounds, Argos and Draco, as they raced down the stairs toward Nina, who was also standing on the tarmac, waiting.
"Kids," the little man said as he brushed past Harvath, "they never listen."
Harvath smiled and walked down the last few stairs. When he reached the bottom, Lara ran up to him and wrapped her arms around his neck.
"I'm so glad you're back."
"Me too,"
he said, kissing her.
"Thank you,"
she said. Harvath looked at her.
"Thank you? For what?"
"For doing what you do. As hard as it is, and as much as I may not like it, thank you."
He wanted to tell her how the dead weighed on his shoulders, how he wished there was some way he could save those who were still going to die, but he couldn't. She got him, though not completely. No one really ever would. But she was better than anything he had ever known, and he loved her immeasurably.
"Come here,"
he said, pulling her closer and kissing her again.
"Do you have any idea how much I love you?"
Lara was about to respond when his cell phone rang.
"Show me," she said.
Looking down at his phone, Harvath silenced the ringer and tucked it into his pocket.
"Good start," she said.
"Tell me what's next."
"There's a little boy who is extremely eager to see you and have you take him fishing."
"I can't wait," Harvath said,
as he put his arm around her and led everyone toward the waiting float plane.
Code of Conduct was written by Brad Thor and read by Armin Schultz. The recording engineer was Kevin Mazur. Editing by Travis Tun and Christina Pachano. Post-production by Hudson Sound. The associate producer was Ben Rimmelauer. Code of Conduct was produced and directed by Karen Perlman. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Code of Conduct by Brad Thor is available in hardcover from Emily Bestler Books and Atrium. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio, Hidden Order and Blacklist, written by Brad Thor and read by Armin Schultz.
Hi, this is Brad Thor, and I am sitting here with my good buddy and the narrator of Code of Conduct, Army Schultz. Hey, Army.
Hi, Brad. It's great to be here with you today. You bring back some of your listeners' favorite characters in Code of Conduct and introduce some intriguing new ones. Are your characters inspired by the people in your personal and professional life?
That's a great question, and it's one that a lot of people ask me, particularly when I'm out on the road. The characters come from all different places in my life, but yes, they do tend to be people I know or little bits and pieces of people. For instance, Scott Harvath, a lot of people don't know that his last name comes from a dear friend of my wife's who processes FISA warrants at the Department of Justice. So I got the Harvath name there, but Scott is spelled with one T. And the reason Scott spells his name with one T is my brother is named Scott with one T. So I named Scott Harvath after my brother. And I asked my mom, I said, why did you give my brother the name S-C-O-T and not S-C-O-T-T the way it's normally spelled? And my mom said, I didn't like the way it would look to have S-C-O-T-T-T-H-O-R. So eventually in the books, I started explaining, because so many fans asked me that same question, and I gave Scott Harvath the middle name Thomas. And I said Scott Harvath's mom didn't want to see S-C-O-T-T-T-H-O-M-A-S. So that's a little bit about Scott Harvath. But one of the big ones that people ask all the time is about the troll and where did the troll come from? Now, I have two children who don't watch Dora the Explorer anymore, but Dora used to be on all the time in my house. And I was fascinated by the grumpy old troll that lived under the bridge. And I thought, that's very interesting. He's a little small guy, but he's got power to control this bridge. And in real life, what might a little person do to have power so that you could be particularly small physically, but you would be able to exert your influence over lots and lots of people? And that's where I got this idea of blackmail, of dealing in the theft and sale of top secret information. And that's where the idea from where the troll came from was Dora the Explorer. So that's a little inside look at some of the characters and how they came out of my personal life.
How much of Scott's evolution is a reflection of yourself as you grow and learn in life, career, marriage, and fatherhood?
It's funny because I tell people that Scott Harvath really is my alter ego, the same way I'm sure James Bond was for Ian Fleming or Jack Ryan for Tom Clancy. The big joke I make is that Scott Harvath gets to go and do the things that my wife won't let me do. And whenever I make that joke in front of her, she says, "I did let you go to Afghanistan." So she's got me on that one. Code of Conduct is my 15th book, and he has grown, and that's part of me growing and maturing not only as an adult, but in the craft of writing, if you will. And the challenge for me as an author really is, how do you write a series character and keep them fresh? How do you reveal a little bit more of Scott Harvath and those supporting characters in each book? And with Code of Conduct, my goal was to be better than I ever have been before. And when I was done with it, my wife said, "Wow, I can really tell that you raised the bar with Code of Conduct." And I said, "What struck you? What did you really think was different about this book?" And she said, "I've always known what Scott Harvath thinks. Now I know what he feels." And that's kind of a neat thing to have people comment on. And I'm already hearing it back from the early readers. They really like that component. They're walking away from this. And I hope all of you who have just listened to Code of Conduct are walking away, too, with a greater appreciation for Scott Harvath. And for those of you who have listened to one of my audio books for the first time, I hope that you really felt a connection with Harvath and the other characters and that you'll go back and listen to the other books in the series.
Many of your listeners say they appreciate the accuracy of the details in your books. You publish a book each year. How long does it take to research them? And what kinds of research do you do to bring authenticity to your writing? How do your sources change from one title to the next?
I call what I do faction. So you don't really know where the facts end and the fiction begins. In fact, one of the nicest compliments I receive is when people listen to my audiobooks, they want to have a laptop open and the search engine right there so they can type things in because they say, "There's no way that's real. Thor made that up." And then they look and they say, "Wow, that actually is very real." So I believe that the details are the bedrock of a great thriller, that you have to get them right. But what I want to do is go beyond just getting the details right and share things with people that they didn't know about. My goal is for you to get to the end of listening to this audiobook and to feel smarter, to have questions about things, to know a little bit more about things than you did when you started. Writers are weird. And Army, you and I have chatted a bunch about how actors are an interesting breed and writers are an interesting breed. But I'm like flypaper for facts and details and information. You asked about details and kind of my sources and things like this. I'm constantly developing new sources, whether it's in the intelligence community, the special operations community. Probably one of the coolest things for me is all of the military, intelligence, and law enforcement people I get to meet, particularly when I'm doing my research. And the research, I do a book a year. So the research can take a few months. It can take a good chunk of the year. Oftentimes, it's ongoing as I'm writing. But the key is for me to pick a topic that I'm interested in because I know then that the listener, the reader, they're going to be interested in it too. And I try to stretch myself to go for a topic that's hard to understand because once I know it, once I've thoroughly researched it, I know that I can put it into a form that's going to be interesting for you, Army, somebody you know, and for all the listeners out there. So my goal always is to get better with each book, but to keep finding new, fresh, exciting things that are true that nobody knows about.
You do your research well, and I always find what I learn in your books so intriguing. How has Scott Harvath grown since the start of the series? Are the key elements that define him in Code of Conduct, are they the same as those that defined him in, say, The Lions of Lucerne?
There's a lot of novels out there where somebody starts out this way and they're different at the end. And this was interesting, a challenge for me to reconcile in writing thrillers, particularly writing that repeat character and how you make him interesting, how you reveal a little bit more about him in each book. But do you really want Scott Harvath to be different at the end of the novel? Do you want James Bond to be different? Do you want Indiana Jones to be different? Because they're not. They are steadfast. They are still the same person at the end as they were at the beginning. Maybe they're wrestling with something that they find a way to overcome by the end, and that's interesting. And we can learn about them by watching them go through internal as well as external struggles. But Scott Harvath, he is every SEAL I have ever known. So when you listen to this book, you're getting a true Navy SEAL. And when you hear Harvath think about those SEAL mottos, that the only easy day was yesterday, that success is the only option, these are real SEAL mottos. And you want the consistency of character in these people that are going out to the far-flung corners of the world and doing the country's most dangerous business. You don't want somebody that doesn't know who he is, who's going to change out there in the field. You need somebody who's very even and consistent and will go out and get the job done. Scott Harvath used to be a real wisecracker and used to have all of these funny lines. He still does, but a little bit of that smart aleckiness that was in him in the beginning actually was based on somebody that I knew. It was part me, part my sense of humor, and I try to let that come out in Scott Harvath, but it was also somebody else who I knew who was a SEAL who had gotten out to do some different things. And it was interesting what you can get away with on a SEAL team versus once you start dealing with politicians and what you can get away with, it's a different thing, and you need to know where that line is. And I found that as I tightened him up a little bit and saved some of the humor and stuff for the people closest to him, how many people patted me on the back and said, you know what, you've nailed it. He can think something funny, but in certain circumstances, if you want to continue to work in the real tight circles of power in D.C., you have to have a check on that. And that's the same as it is in the Navy. You wouldn't walk up to an admiral and say, hey, you know, a giraffe, a cow, and a chicken walk into a bar. You have to mind your P's and Q's. So there's been a little bit of growth in Harvath, but it's growth in revealing his character and who he is. And I think that what people love about my books, there's a few things. The action starts in the first minute. It goes on and on and on throughout the whole book. Lots of intrigue. You learn a ton from the books. But Harvath becomes a friend. And even for me writing him, I miss him when I'm not writing him during the year. And I look forward to coming back and spending time with him. And if he was completely different each time or changed too much each time, wouldn't be fun for me. And I think that's the same for all of you that are out there listening.
No, it's true. I wouldn't want Scott to change. So let me ask you, where does your passion for storytelling come from? How does writing continue to interest, engage, and challenge you?
I like to make a joke about the Son of Sam. Not very funny, but Davy Berkowitz, the Son of Sam, the killer, because I think Adam Sandler had made a joke about what his mother had said when they discovered Son of Sam. And his dog told him to do it. And I joke with my writing is that I write because I have no other choice. It's the only way to silence the voices in my head. I have to tell stories. I have to get them out. I have more stories in me than I'll ever be able to tell in my lifetime. It's what I've always wanted to do since I was a little boy, is to be a storyteller. I remember that when I graduated college, I'd save money. I'd done a little study abroad when it was in my junior year, and I'd moved to Paris. After I graduated school back in the United States, I went back to Paris, and I took a laptop with me, and I started writing. Didn't know what I was going to write, didn't outline anything, very original, right? Going to Paris to write a novel. I was the first guy ever to do it. But I started writing, and a thriller started coming out of me. And I got a couple chapters into it, started same way I do my stuff now, started with a big action scene, and I got a couple chapters into it and I quit. I was afraid what would happen if I took this year off and wrote a novel and nobody liked it. What if I didn't get it published? And I think all of us have that little voice inside that says, don't do this. You may embarrass yourself. What if it fails? On and on and on. And I've shortened a slogan that says a mind is a terrible thing to waste. And I just said a mind is a terrible thing, period, because it can really talk you out of some of the best things that you should be doing with your life. And I believe that which you're most destined to do, you're often the most afraid of. So I dropped being a novelist. I decided not to. I ended up creating a television show, a travel show on public television, and did that. And in my second season of the show, my wife and I were on our honeymoon, and we happened to be in Italy at the time. And she asked me, what would you regret on your deathbed never having done? And before I could pull the words back out of the air and shove them right back into my mouth, I said, writing a book and getting it published. And she said, well, then when we get home, you need to start spending 2 hours protected time every day. No phone, no email, no nothing, except making that dream come true. And that's why I became a writer. It's thanks to my wife calling me on it and saying, you got to do it. And then, you know, here I am married. I don't want her to think she married a guy who doesn't have the courage to go after his dreams. So I have her to thank for that in keeping the world at bay when I write. But that's where my writing comes from. It's that deep passion. And I'm engaged by it because I go after topics I want to learn more about with each book. And because I work for you, all of you who are listening to this, I work for you. So my goal is to get better, to give you a better product every single year because you're important to me. You are my boss, and I want you to keep coming back. And that only works if I deliver for you. So that's what keeps me going. It's you. It's my love of writing. It's my love of doing research. And you have made a very rewarding and just exciting career possible. And I can't thank you enough.
Your passion for writing is so inspiring. Women play an important role in your writing. Can you talk about that?
This is a slam dunk question for me. I am surrounded by incredibly brilliant, talented women, whether it's at Simon & Schuster, whether it's at my agent's office, whether it's just the people in my own office, whether it's my wife. I am blessed in that I have all of these incredible women around me. But probably the most important thing is I'm a father of a young lady. And I want female characters in my books that women readers will love and that male readers will love. Ever since my very first novel, The Lions of Lucerne, I have never, and including that novel, I have never had women be sex objects. They're not just window dressing. They are integral to the plot. Things can't be achieved without their cooperation and participation with Scott Harvath. Now, I've had bad female characters, meaning they were at odds with Harvath. I've done villainesses, if you will, and I've had great ones. But every single novel has had strong female characters because I'm not just writing for men. I have male and female listeners to the audio versions, readers of the printed versions. And that to me is very important that I do justice to both sexes in the book because, again, readers are who I work for. And so they're very, very important to me. But at the end of the day, I want my daughter to be able to pick up these books. Not now. She's a little young at the moment. But at some point, I want her to pick these up and I want her to aspire to the traits that she sees in these characters in the books. Very important to me. And you can aspire to the traits of the men and the women. But it was really important to me that I do justice and honor all of the women in my life by being respectful and creating great characters for them as well as for all the readers.
One of the things you say in Code of Conduct is, you can't choose the situation you're in, but you can choose how you react to it. How does that statement inform your own life?
Well, that statement comes from my mom. I remember hearing that all of the time. My mom was like a broken record. You can't always choose the situation you find yourself in, but you can choose how you react to it. And it's funny to be here on my 15th book with Code of Conduct and to have finally included that. I don't know where it came from. I have a great T-shirt that my wife gave me that said, "Be careful or you'll wind up in my novel." It's kind of a funny thing, but it's also be careful what you say around me because it can be in my novel. The last one I did, I have a lovely woman named Yvonne who works with me, and she made a great crack that I put in the last book in Act of War where there's a bottle of Chardonnay in Harvath's refrigerator, and he refers to it as debutante heroin. And I had never heard that line before, and it just absolutely cracked me up. And that's part of my sense of humor coming through, but that is that be careful what you say around Brad Thor because it can come in. And by the way, I have put people in the books that I don't like. I've made them bad guys. I've taken people I absolutely love and put them in the books.
So I should watch out about what I say around you or else I may show up in your next book.
At some point, Army, maybe you and I will talk about this. We might not get into it today, but there's a lot of hidden stuff in my book, in all of them. So there's layers in everything I do. You remember when we worked together on Full Black And I actually hid a lot of references to George Orwell in 1984 in Full Black. And if you go back and listen to Full Black again, or for the first time if you haven't heard it, if you know you're George Orwell, if you know you're 1984, you're going to find some really cool things that you go, wait a second, I know what that means. And wait, he took two characters and put their names together and named one character in Full Black. So there's a lot of fun stuff. And that's me having fun. And I like to plant those Easter eggs for you all in the books.
Are there any of those Easter eggs in Code of Conduct?
Yes, Army, I did do some things in Code of Conduct as well. I'd love to give you a hint. Let me just say this. I won't tell you who, but there is a character, and their name in this book is significant. I won't tell you why. I won't tell you how, because I don't want to ruin it for everybody who's listening. But I think if you take a look at one of the particular characters, you'll realize, if I rearrange the letters in that name, what might that spell? But that's it. That's all I'm giving you.
Oh, wow. All right, tell me. No, I want to know.
Yeah, no. He's looking at me right now like he's reaching for his wallet or something like that. Like, yeah, like Army could buy me into revealing this. No, I'm not giving away the secret. That's all I'm going to say on that one.
There are new exotic locations in Code of Conduct. Have you been to all the settings in this novel? How do you choose the locations for your thrillers?
I don't necessarily get to visit every place I want to go to. When I went to Afghanistan for The Apostle, that was a really big deal. And in this book, I've got Congo in there, as you all know from having listened to it. If I can't go myself for whatever reason, I want to talk to somebody who's been there and knows it very well. And that's what I did with Congo. I talked to somebody who had conducted operations there and was very, very familiar with it. So I could draw from their experience. What did it sound like? What did it smell like? What did it look like, of course? What struck you the most? When you close your eyes and you think about these places in Congo, what is it you remember? And what's interesting is when you lead people through that activity, you pull out some really, really cool details, whether it's the food or the beer, two things that made it into this book, whether it's the type of vehicles, the way the houses are built, how the people act, how they dress. So that's all really important to me, is that I'm as authentic as possible. And if I can't go, I want to be one degree away from it. I did something in my last book, which hopefully you all have listened to, Act of War. I did North Korea. And I included China. And those have been two locations that I'd always thought, oh, I don't want to go to Asia, Japan, China. You know, it didn't excite me. And then I started researching for Act of War, and I got excited. Same thing happened here with Code of Conduct, because I'd been to Geneva, Switzerland multiple times. So Geneva was a slam dunk, the Washington, D.C. area, real easy to do. Congo, I was like, Africa. Really haven't done Africa. North Africa, of course, because there have been some terrorist scenarios. Pat the Assassin had Egypt in it, so on and so forth. But the more I learned about Congo, the more I was interested. I found cool little micro documentaries on YouTube, and I could see it for myself. So I did everything I could for the research to put you there. And of course, the real proof is in the pudding. It's you, Army, and how you deliver it. And, you know, they're my words, but together, I think we really did a good job with this one, transporting people there. And I hope all of you out there agree.
A hallmark of your thrillers is that the plots are ahead of the headlines. Are you ever troubled by what you learn in your research? And how do you keep a positive perspective?
There's a lot of stuff out there that's pretty spooky. I like Dennis Miller, the comedian, because he's one of the smartest comedians out there. And Dennis talks about a president's first day at the White House. He believes that your first day on the job, you get put on Air Force One, you get to go out to Area 51 and give the alien that they've got out there a purple nurple, and then you come back and you have to sit down in the Oval Office and they clunk down a huge binder, and you get to see how big, bad, and ugly the world is and how terrifying it is. There's a lot to be frightened of out there, a lot. There's a lot to be frightened even here inside our own country. We talk about terrorist cells and all this kind of stuff. I take heart in the fact that we have so many incredibly brave men and women out there who are willing to protect us. I say there can't be an American dream without those people willing to defend it. So I try to focus there I try to focus on how hard it is for them and what can I do to make their lives better, to make the lives for their families better. And how do I show them that they're important to me? And that's part of what I'm doing as an author, is there are people out there who technically don't exist, as they're referred to. And I've had people come up to me or send me notes and say, thank you for giving a voice to those of us who, you know, we can't go out and say, I did this or I did that. But you're explaining to people what we go through and what it's like. I hope you had a great time listening to Code of Conduct, because that's the idea. And it's fun for me to write it, and it's fun for me to show those worlds. And so what I do is for you, and is in part for them, to bring honor and to give you a peek, to really let you walk up to the fence line and peer over the top and see what these people in special operations and in the intelligence community are doing, because I think everybody benefits and we all walk away smarter.
You've done a great job in enlightening us so that we know what it's like in special ops. What would you be doing if you were not an author?
Oh, that's such a tough question. This is what I love. There's nothing else I'd want to do than to be an author. I have such high regard for our men and women in uniform, those men and women in the intelligence community. I think those would be incredibly honorable and amazingly challenging and rewarding careers to pursue. You know, I'd love to say, yeah, I'd go out and be a Navy SEAL, or I'd want to join the CIA. I actually applied to join the CIA back in the days when I had my television show. I didn't even get a call back. I thought that'd be great cover for me, that I could have this TV show out there, blah, blah, blah. And I had a reason to travel around the world and go in and out of different countries. Never got a call back. But that's okay. I think I found my calling in writing. I'm hoping I did. I love this job. So I think if I could wave a magic wand, would it be to be in the unit, Delta Force, or with the SEALs? I think that would be a lot of fun. But boy, I got to tell you, I don't tuck myself in at night and say, I wish I was doing something else. Right here, right now, with you, the listeners, is the very place I want to be.
I'm glad you're doing what you love. What's your favorite quote, and what does it mean to you?
My mom had this, printed it out on her printer, and had it taped to the wall in our apartment when I was in grade school and high school. And it was a quote from the German poet Goethe. And I used to close my TV show, my old travel show, with this. And I think it is applicable to everything I've done in my life. And probably you could find a way to apply it to yours, which is, if you can dream it, you can do it. I really, really believe that. I am so glad I had that dream to become an author. And I'm so glad that even though I ran away from it once, I was led back to it by my beautiful, wonderful wife, who said, if that's your dream, you have to do it. Because if you can dream it, you can do it. And I really, really believe that.
That's a great quote. Hey, it's been great being able to chat with you. It's always an honor to narrate your books. I hope I see you again soon.
Thank you, Army. It's always great to see you and fun to do these things. And I wish the listeners could be with us. You know, we've done some dinners together. You know my wife. And we always get a kick out of seeing you on TV when one of your commercials pops up. But I get more compliments on your narration of these audio versions of my books. And that means a lot. You know, I know you see the listeners the way I do and how important they are. And people say, Brad, why don't you narrate your own books? And I say, because Army does it the best. And I couldn't do it as well as you do, Army. So I just really appreciate it. And it's fun working with you year after year after year. And here's to many, many more.